You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including the lasting legacy of Tule Lake, a proposed nickel mine in southern Oregon, and affordable housing for older adults in Phoenix. I'm Maria Carter, JPR's news director.
I'm Jane Vaughn, housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
And I'm Roman Vitalia, science, environment, and politics reporter.
Roman, you went to Tule Lake last weekend. It's just over the border in California, and that's the site of a former camp where Japanese Americans were incarcerated during World War II. What were you doing there?
Yeah, so I was there for this pilgrimage that is held every 2 years to visit this former campsite. So there were about 400 people there for a multi-day event that included tours of the remaining buildings, you know, talks and like kind of general bonding between the group. I was there specifically on Saturday for a memorial service that they hold for the 331 people who died at this camp during World War II. Then I also kind of, you know, learn more about how people who are in these camps are now using their experiences to speak out against modern day immigration enforcement.
Interesting. So what's the history of the Tule Lake camp?
Yeah. So for those who don't know, and that was one of the issues we heard about, was that people don't learn enough about these camps. But after the attack on Pearl Harbor, over 100,000 Japanese Americans were rounded up and sent to these camps across the country. So Tule Lake was the largest of these 10 relocation centers. It had a peak population of almost 19,000. It was also the last camp to close in March of 1946. And it was known to be one of, if not the harshest camp, had the harshest conditions. So Tule Lake was eventually converted into what they called a segregation center, which was basically a maximum security camp where the government held people that they had considered disloyal. There were shortages of medical supplies. There were poor food. There were, you know, barbed wire fences, guard towers all over the place, frequent protests. Some incarcerated people were beaten and held for months without due process. And the army eventually took over because of the violent conditions and declared martial law for a time. So it was not a great place.
And why did they start these pilgrimages there?
Yeah, so they started them in the late 1960s. It was sort of an informal thing at first, and then kind of over time, it's become this biannual tradition that's organized by this group called the Tule Lake Committee. There are other pilgrimages to the other camps as well, like the one in Idaho, and they're kind of meant to ensure that people remember what happened to the camps and, you know, remember the people who lived and died there. So I talked to the organizer of this pilgrimage, Hiroshi Setsuki, who said that, you know, he's trying to redefine how people see Tule Lake, not as a camp for troublemakers, but, you know, it's where the government put people who spoke out. So he said that part of the reason people were protesting was because of the unfair treatment they were getting, and the government was kind of presenting them with this binary choice. They were saying you're either pro-American or you're pro-Japan.
People were not against Japan, America, but they were not for the treatment that they were getting. And they were not necessarily pro-Japan, but they were insulted by being characterized as a lesser people.
And that was something I heard from other people, too, was that kind of the reason people were angry and bitter and rebellious was, you know, it was because of how they were being treated by the government, not because of other reasons.
And you talk to a lot of people who are actually in these camps, living there during World War II, what did they have to say about their experiences?
Yeah, Hiroshi, who organizes the pilgrimage, lived in the camps. He lived in a lot of the different camps, but a lot of the people I talked to were very young at the time. You know, now they're much older, but, you know, some were born in the camps themselves. I did talk to some people, interestingly, that a lot of them seem to have stayed in the U.S. by sort of sheer luck. I talked to Setsuki Ina, who says that, you know, because her father was arrested for speaking out against the camps, they were going to be deported to Japan.
Miraculously, my family was protected from being deported thanks to the efforts of Wayne Collins, the ACLU attorney that proved to the courts that to renounce one's citizenship during wartime when you're in your own country is illegal and unconstitutional.
Yeah, there were others too that, you know, were deceived or coerced into renouncing their citizenship and go to Japan, even, you know, if they were born in the U.S. and had never even been to Japan in the first place. I talked to a lot I talked and learned a lot about how the survivors of the camp, especially the ones who were older at the time, didn't want to talk about their experiences once they got out. Ina is also a psychologist, and she said she's talked to a lot of survivors who say that they didn't want to pass that trauma on to the next generation. Her father never spoke about the camps after they got out. One woman I also talked to said that she was eventually able to reconnect with her heritage later on, but said that it was really hurtful that, you know, the Japanese American community kind of discouraged speaking out at all after the war. But now the younger generation wants to know more about what happened at these camps and is trying to get the older generations to talk about their experiences.
And it also sounds like a lot of the survivors from these camps are now activists.
Yeah, Satsuki and others I talked to are now, you know, activists and have formed these groups protesting modern-day immigration enforcement. You know, the story that I report on goes into how they kind of see a need to be there for other people because nobody was there for them when they were imprisoned. So, you know, most of the people on the pilgrimage ended up gathering with these protest signs and did some chants after the memorial ceremony to, you know, warn about the events of the past and why they shouldn't be repeated. So, you know, I mean, clearly that what's happening with modern day immigration enforcement is different in many aspects, but, you know, these survivors I talked to are still worried that the lessons that the government should have learned during World War II have not really stuck.
Okay, well, thank you, Roman. Jane, you covered a new housing project coming to the Rogue Valley. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so that's a new project that is called Phoenix Commons, and it's going to be built in Phoenix. There will be 40 units of modular housing, so they'll be built in a factory, basically, which is hopefully quicker, which is the idea, than stick-built. And there'll be duplexes that'll be built to look like cottages. They're meant for lower-income older adults. The idea is that they'll be affordable, accessible, people can age in place. And this whole project is led by the nonprofit H Plus and supported by a $7.8 million grant from Oregon Housing and Community Services, which is the state's housing agency.
And why is this housing needed?
So the goal of this in particular is to focus on housing that was lost in the 2020 Alameda fire. We've done some reporting on other housing projects in our region. Some, like Royal Oaks, took much longer to be rebuilt than expected. This is clearly an ongoing process to rebuild, even almost 6 years later after the Alameda fire. It destroyed about 2,300 residences in the Rogue Valley, and about 1,500 of those were manufactured homes. So the efforts to rebuild that particular type of housing is still continuing years later.
And how will the project work?
So some of the modular homes are specifically set aside for people who are aged 55 and over, people who make 50% of the area median income, and disabled folks. And then the rest are for people who are 55 and over who make 60% of the area's median income. There will also be a community center for activities on site. They will offer things like rides to the grocery store, companionship, health with technology, those types of services for people. And H Plus has already done two similar projects in Talent, so they do have some experience with it, and so they're doing another one in Phoenix this time.
And do we know the timeline for this project to open?
Loosely, but not concretely. Even with that state grant that I mentioned, H Plus still needs to fundraise about $300,000 to $400,000 in order to be able to complete the project. If people want to donate, they can. They're confident they'll be able to get the money, but that does take some work and some time. I talked to the CEO, who said optimistically the site would open in 13 to 14 months. Realistically, she says it'll be closer to 15 to 18 months. So we'll have to see as it gets going.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Jane. Justin, you had a feature this week on a proposed nickel mine in our region. Who wants to mine nickel, and where do they want to mine it?
Yeah, so I did this story on a Canadian company's claims in southwestern Oregon. That company is named Homeland Nickel, and they've been snatching up claims around this area, and a lot of them are in Curry County, but also some in Josephine County. They have 9 claims covering thousands of acres, a lot of that within national forest land. And they're interested in the nickel in these areas. JPR's covered interest in nickel mining before. Our former news director, Liam, had reported on this years ago when a different company had these claims. And so it's been a long debate in this area, you know, mining companies wanting to tap these resources, and then on the other side, environmental groups and local communities really concerned about the ecological impact. But I reported that a couple things have happened recently that might finally make these nickel mines a reality, and one is demand for nickel.
And demand for nickel is growing. Why is that?
Yeah, so the International Energy Agency forecasts nickel demand will actually double by 2040, and the agency predicts the world will need 60 new moderately sized nickel mines by 2030 to keep up with that demand. And the reason demand is growing is basically comes down to electric vehicle batteries. So in the past, nickel was mostly important for stainless steel products. It actually still is. So it's mostly used for alloys like stainless steel. But a lot of the future demand is projected to come from these EV batteries. And there's actually some debate here on, you know, what battery technology will be more dominant and what that will look like. But these forecasts supposedly take that into account. So basically the world will likely just need a lot more nickel. Right now, most nickel comes from Indonesia. China has invested really heavily in mining critical minerals there. And the country has dealt with the environment impacts of that, which is relevant to the story, and I'll talk more about later. But Homeland Nickel says these claims in Southern Oregon have a lot of nickel. I visited a site called Red Flat in Curry County. It's within the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest. That's a 2,000-acre mining claim, and it's estimated to have over 300 million pounds of nickel. And then there's the nearby Cleopatra claim. That's thought to hold more than 700 million pounds of nickel. That would be the largest nickel deposit in North America. And at current prices, Homeland Nickel estimates Southern Oregon has around $6 billion worth of this metal.
And you report that Oregon actually has a history with nickel mining?
Yeah, the largest nickel mine in U.S. history was in Douglas County near Riddle, and that operated for decades with the government support. The federal government thought it was important to have a domestic nickel supply. That closed in the 90s, and, you know, neighbors of the mine enjoyed the economic opportunity at the time. They enjoyed the high-paying jobs, but there was a cost. So locals complained about health impacts from dust and air pollution, and some think the mine would have probably faced harsher regulatory pressure, but it just closed down before, you know, the federal government took action.
And there's environmental concerns about mining these claims in southwestern Oregon then and now, it sounds like.
Yeah, so proposed nickel mining, you know, isn't new here, like I mentioned. And what's also not new is pushback from local communities and environmental groups. I visited the one proposed site, like I mentioned, Red Flat. It's in that national forest, and it's actually in what's called a withdrawal area. So in 2016, the Forest Service put some temporary protections on 100,000 acres, including this land that where this claim is. And those protections include a ban on new mining activity or development. And that was because of the threat of mining. Environmental groups supported this. Also, Republican commissioners at the time supported it. They were worried that mining could impact the watershed. There's nearby salmon and trout habitats. And it would also just fundamentally change the landscape. This is undeveloped backcountry. But because Red Flat is a historic claim, it's kind of grandfathered in, so Homeland Nickel can mine this area if they get through the permitting process with the Forest Service. And to get the nickel from this mountain, they would basically remove the top layer of the soil, maybe down to 50 feet or more, process that soil, remove the nickel, refine it nearby, and then return the soil to the mountain.
And how is Homeland Nickel responding to the environmental concerns?
They say they understand those concerns, especially because nickel mining doesn't have a great track record of, you know, with the environment. But Homeland Nickel basically says that times have changed. They plan to reforest their mining claim as they go. So they'll mine a few hundred acres, dump the soil back, replant that land with native seeds before they move on to another area. They also note that this kind of soil they leave after removing the nickel isn't toxic, which is a concern, leaving toxic tailings. And the company says the economic benefit will be worth any temporary damage. So they estimate it could employ up to 1,000 people for decades for the life of the mine. And this region doesn't have a lot of high-paying jobs right now since the decline of timber. So you could understand why that could be important.
And why is this project really coming up right now?
The administration is very pro-mining, so they've directed agencies to speed up the permitting process.
And we're talking about the presidential administration.
Yeah, that's right, President Trump. And Homeland Nichols says they've seen an impact. The Forest Service is much, you know, responds much quicker to them in this permitting process.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Justin. I'm sure we'll stay following that. That's it for the debrief this week. Thank you for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line. That's on our website, ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more at jeffexchange.org. or on your favorite podcast platform. Don't go away. Up next, a century after author Zane Grey built his cabin along the Rogue River, archaeologists are working to preserve the place that inspired many of his stories. That's coming up next on Underground History.